And Dustin, you know, when Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead, it was so that he could vote Democrat.
Is that so?
Yep.
That's so very interesting. Did you get that from your book?
Yes, I did.
Yeah? Did you order that book and the shirt together?
You know, this this shirt kind of reminds me that we need to follow Disney's lead and have more diversity in our show, because it's just the two of us. You know, when we need to add members of the LGBTQABCMICKEY.
Yeah, MOUSC. Anyways, well, you'll be delighted to know that our guest is actually a white male evangelical. And he will be joining us, and so that should be thrilling for you and the people that you were trying to represent.
All right, let's see it. I'll say something to him at a protest.
I can't wait to be there. Hey, what's up, everyone? Welcome to another episode of the Sons of History podcast. I apologize.
Children of History.
Children of History, because we're super inclusive.
Trying to be more inclusive.
Yeah, so I apologize. I'm Dustin Bass. I don't know what the hell I am. Who are you?
Alan Joaquim, but you can call me... What? No, I was going to say you can call me Damn It Jesus Christ or Shirley.
Hey, whoa.
What?
What is that from?
Well, damn it, Jesus Christ, Bill Cosby, come on. Oh, you know what? We shouldn't have mentioned Bill Cosby. Okay, Shirley, that's from Airplane.
Don't call me
Shirley. So those will be my pronouns. Damn it, Jesus Christ and Shirley.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Remember what I talked about earlier, that he's evangelical? You may take offense. Anyways.
You know what? The very fact that he's a white male evangelical offends me.
That's true. That shirt is hideous. All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a good time on this show. We've got a really cool guest. He's going to be joining us. He's actually managing editor over at the Babylon Bee and co-author of the Babylon Bee Guide to Wokeness. But before we get there, I don't really like how this is going. Do you?
Why? What do you mean? I told you we need more inclusion.
It just feels weird.
Well, is it this shirt? Is it still this shirt?
I don't know.
Well, all right. But you know what? This is a good time for us to talk about This Week in History.
All right. Well, I will go first. I'm really out of my element because I don't know who I am. You know, I can't identify correctly. I used to be able to. First 40 years of my life, I was able to identify exactly what I am. Now it's all up in the air. I can't figure it out.
I think you can be whatever you want to be. We like to call ourselves doctors, don't we?
Yeah. Doctor.
So, doctor.
Doctor.
Okay.
Doctor.
And why are we shaking hands? Shouldn't we do...
I don't know. There we go. Thanks. good thinking. All right. So my This Week in History goes all the way back to 1949, April 4th, 1949. And what happens? Well, 12 nations, Belgium, Canada, Denmark, France, Iceland, Italy, Luxembourg, Netherlands, Norway, Portugal, the United Kingdom, and the United States all sign the North Atlantic Treaty. And this formed NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization. So that's when that all got started, just about 4 years after the end of World War II. Now, this was the dream, and it's interesting because this was the dream that's going to tie into the war that you're going to reference, League of Nations. This was the dream of Woodrow Wilson finally come to life under our, well, big push from FDR, but he was dead by then. So now it started out with 12 nations. Now there are 30 nations in NATO, and there's been a massive expansion to the east, which makes you think maybe Russia does have a reason for concern, cause for concern about encroachment on their borders. I know I would.
Well, I mean, that would... I mean, the Baltic nations, you know, Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, they were part of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. Now they are NATO. You know, there's you can go on both sides to this argument, but that did lead. The consequences were that led up to Georgia, the wars in Georgia and the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So,
yep.
I personally think they should have included Russia when Boris Yeltsin was president in the 90s. We should have included Russia into NATO.
Yeah.
I don't, you know, Turkey and Greece are, they've been enemies for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and the Turks have also been at war with many of the Balkan nations. But now that they're part of NATO, Turkey has not gone to, other than what happened in Cyprus,
yeah.
Turkey hasn't gone to war with Greece since then. So just something to think about. Maybe, you know, I think we should have included them.
Yeah.
So now mine goes back to 1917. Now, granted, yes, now that's going to be the last. That's actually today, April the 2nd, when we're taping this. April the 2nd, President Woodrow Wilson asked a joint session of Congress for a declaration of war. So, but we're going to look at April 4th and April the 6th. On April the 4th, the Senate went ahead and agreed to the declaration of war by a vote of 82-6. You know, back then, you know, we didn't have Hawaii or Alaska. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we had 48 states. So in a vote 82-6, the Senate passed the declaration. And then 2 days later, it was around 3 a.m, I think, on April the 6th, the House passed the declaration 373-50. And it was signed later that day by President Woodrow Wilson. And we were at war with the German Empire. It wasn't until December the 7th when we were at war with Austria-Hungary, their main ally. So, interesting things. Representative Jeanette Rankin of Montana votes no to the World War I declaration. She's also the same person, the lone voter, lone rep who voted no in 1941 when it came to declaring war on Japan.
Pacifist?
She's a pacifist, yeah. She was a Republican out of Montana. She voted no for World War I and World War II. So
she's the only
person. Yep, only person in 1941 who voted no against the war with Japan. Now, now Woodrow Wilson campaigned on the fact that since 1914, there was war going on in Europe, you know, and this is 1916 when he was campaigning, Woodrow Wilson. But, you know, back then we did not get entangled with the European wars. George Yep. Washington told us not to. So he campaigned and won the election in 1916, stating he kept us out of war, kept us out of the European war.
Yep.
But, you know, a couple of problems occurred January and February of 1917. You had Germany lifted the unrestricted submarine warfare, and a lot of American ships got sunk. And then there was the Zimmermann telegram.
Yeah.
Which asked Mexico, it was something about Mexico and Japan. I know Japan was involved, that if Mexico invades the United States, they can take like Texas, California, you know, the southern, southwestern states, and Japan can do their part, even though Japan was an ally of Britain. But all that, just Wilson was like, all right, I know I campaigned to keep us out of war, but as soon as he you know, took the oath of office, very next month.
Yep.
Because back then, March was when they, March or April was when
I'm
they
reading
did the,
a book. I'm reading a book on the very thing, The Approaching Storm by Neil Langto. He's going to be on the show pretty soon about that whole, you know, he ties in Wilson, Teddy Roosevelt, and Jane Addams, you know, the pacifist, and how they viewed how getting into the war. What a situation, but a fantastic book. I'm very much enjoying it. So. Yeah.
Wilson changed things. I mean, we used to be more of a, you know, neutral. But Wilson was the one that he, not only after the war was over, but now he wanted us to get heavily involved, give up some of our sovereignty with the League of Nations.
Yep.
He was for the Treaty of Versailles, which really led to World War II. So it, it was a change of American policy, Wilsonian, you know, democracy
Wilsonian
and whatnot.
Democracy, So crazy stuff. But what fantastic choices. Well done, doctor.
Doctor, thank you.
Yeah. Or nurse. With that shirt,
I'm
going to go with registered nurse. Not a lot of men in your profession.
What about what's his name? Ben Stiller. Yes,
yeah, that's what I was going for. Yeah. You look like Ben Stiller. Do you identify as Ben Stiller? Well, can you identify with his money? That would be great.
Well, you know, I do find myself really, really, really ridiculously good looking. But I do think there's more to it than
absolutely. That. Yeah, so, probably so. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that is This Week in History. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, without further ado, we've got a very special guest, Joel Berry. He is the co-author of The Babylon Bee Guide to Wokeness. This is an absolutely hilarious book, satirical, sadly true,
yeah,
in pretty much every page you turn. If you want to know the present situation and then also the future of where this country is heading, if we continue down this progressive path, and keep in mind, progressive of the Wilsonian era, very, very different than the progressives of the modern era. But this is a very funny, very good book. Highly recommend, because one, you'll be cracking up laughing, but you'll also be wiping away tears of sadness seeing where, how far this country has more or less, yeah, fallen with its just absolute stupidity.
I mean, was it, if I'm pronouncing his name correctly, Aldous Huxley,
mm-hmm,
The Brave New World, yep, that type of life is...
Yeah, right, know, there. So, yeah, and he's also the managing editor of The Babylon Bee. You can check that out at thebabylonbee.com or follow them like I do, and I'm sure you do, on Instagram and get all of their satirical feet. It's, oh man, I repost, yeah, their stuff all the time because it's spot on. And speaking of being spot on, we're going to bring Joel Berry on. He is on the line. Joel, how are you doing, man?
Doing good. Thanks for having me, guys.
Hey, man, it's, I can already sense it's going to be a pretty fun conversation. Lots of laughs. LOL.
I think this should be I've always wanted to thank you guys for that Star Wars picture, the one with Rose and Finn stating that we Star Wars fans are going to get reparations for the god-awful movies that they came out with.
Well, I got to say, you're the first person that's mentioned our Star Wars jokes as your favorite. And I appreciate that because I love telling those jokes. And they're usually, we pretty much are telling them for ourselves, you know, not for anyone out there. So it's nice to know there's someone out there that likes them.
Well, I've been a Star Wars fan. I was 10 years old when the first one came out. And to see what they've done to it, just kind of.
Yeah, it's a joke. Yeah. I didn't think it could get worse than The Phantom Menace.
Oh, it got worse.
It did.
I have this weird nostalgic affection for the prequels now. You know, like the dialogue and acting is so horrible, but it was still Star Wars to me. It at least tried to remain true to that, like that myth, that modern myth that Star Wars has always been. And then the kind of the deconstructionists came in and ruined it. It still bugs me years later.
Yeah. That's a good way to look at it. That's a positive way to look at it. That was The Phantom Menace was, I guess you would say, my Vietnam. Yeah. I hate it. I had to go through it.
Well, it's funny because I have little brothers. I'm the oldest of six, so I have two little brothers. And for them, the prequels were like their first introduction to Star Wars. So I first saw Star Wars when it was re-released in theaters in the 90s, like with the special edition. That was my first, so I got to see it for the first time in theaters. And so that was like an amazing experience for me. And then my little brothers, their first introduction was to the prequels. So to them, that's kind of like how they think of Star Wars as the prequels, which is just, it's just such a tragedy.
Yeah. Speaking of tragedy, what is it? Anakin Skywalker, when he's laying there without any limbs, reminds me of your recent tweet about, I guess the correlation between like anorexic and transgender, like we should, start cutting off the limbs and stuff, like how jacked up society is. And y'all's book is sort of a reference. It's a reference to how jacked up society is and how we accept it as, oh, this is the new normal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So,
which is going to lead me to my first question is that this book, unfortunately, is sold under false pretenses. Because it's supposed to be satirical, but all of this stuff is happening. All of the stuff in your book is happening right now. It's actually happening. So I wouldn't call this satirical. I would say that this is now an instructional book.
Yeah, it is weird. It does have this kind of this weird two-edged. I don't know what you want to call it. It kind of works two ways because we. a lot of it does feel very like just a straight up retelling of what's going on and this ideology. Kind of our, I guess the conceit for writing the book was that we were kind of summarizing this ideology from the standpoint of someone who believes in it, who's telling other people how to believe in it, but they're maybe being a little too honest, they're not really self-aware about it. And they're just straight up, you know, they're not trying to disguise their words or parse their words like a lot of the kind of the priests of wokeness do. They're just, they're like they're a true believer, but they don't really know how to put it in a nice palatable package. So you're just getting the straight, the straight story of what wokeness is there. And we did get, it's funny because we do get some criticism, like, this isn't satirical, guys. This is just, you're just telling this is a retelling of what's going on. And that's what's so crazy about it. That's what makes our job as satirists so hard is this, the culture and this particularly this ideology has become so absurd. It's devolved into self-satire. You know, it's kind of hard to exaggerate it beyond its own absurdity. So it's kind of a fun thing going on with the book there.
Yeah. Do you guys have a hard time keeping up with all the material the left gives you?
Yeah. There are several times where we've had ideas for a joke or for a headline, only for it to happen before we can click publish. That's how like close to the real world we've got it, and it seems like it's sped up. Like, we used to publish something, it would happen maybe a year later, a few months later. Now it seems like we're like only weeks ahead of reality, and now it's almost like reality is caught up to us, where sometimes reality even beats us. So it's a constant challenge in that sense, but it's also in one sense it's hard, but in another sense it's easy, because the culture is just giving us so much low-hanging fruit to joke about, you know, that that other comedians don't touch. You know, I would never claim that we're the greatest comedians out there. We're just picking up the low-hanging fruit that, you know, Colbert and the late night hosts and a lot of the comedians out there aren't touching. So hey, we'll take it.
It may be because those guys are also true believers, much like my friend Alan Joaquim. Well, so this Babylon guide has become part of his collection.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at it is, this is an instructional book that goes hand in hand with, let's see, there's Saul Alinsky's Rules for Radicals.
Ooh, that's good, yeah. You like, I didn't think one? Of that. That's right. Good.
I got the Communist Manifesto. Mm-hmm. Let's see. I've got the 3-volume in one, Das Kapital. It has all three.
Wow, is it really that thick? I didn't.
That, yes.
Look at the. Can you see the guy on the back of this freaking? Like, look at that. Can you see that? Like,
is that a fedora? Or what?
Fedora. Look at that. That's guy. A fedora with a bow tie and a multicolored button-down shirt.
Let's see. Wow. See. Imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism. These are, by the way, by Lenin. State and revolution.
Of course.
And of course, you have to have Chairman Mao's little red book.
He's a good man.
Oh, wow. What a great collection. I am honored that you are counting our books as worthy companion pieces to those great masterpieces there.
Uh-huh. Well, and so, I mean, why'd you get all those books anyways?
Oh, well, when I went and got Mein Kampf, people were accusing me of being a Nazi, so I had to balance it out.
Gotta balance it out.
By buying all these other books.
So now the guy with the fedora is knocking on your door.
You better make sure that you don't get on the wrong side of the law, because if the FBI raids your house, it's going to be a treasure trove of extremism.
Yeah, so
hold on. My family's from Lebanon, so all I got to say is, hey, you can't touch me because I'm Middle Eastern, and otherwise you're going to, you know, I'll use, I don't know, what's my intersectionality card, would you say, that this falls under?
What, Lebanese?
Yeah, Lebanese. I got this shirt, you know, I've got these. Certainly the government, especially under this one, will leave me alone with because I can throw my intersectionality card. Is that the right word?
Yeah. Well, and earlier you alluded to a little bit of, kind of, you hinted some sexual deviant stuff going on there too, that that can add some oppression points.
If I had lived in Florida and was allowed to learn about these things from kindergarten through the third grade, I think I would be a much more balanced person.
You'd be much further along. So, on a serious note, well, somewhat serious note, you sort of mentioned that you guys are touching things that a lot of comedians aren't. And I think to an extent, they're not as bold as a Bill Burr. They're definitely not as almost as powerful and as untouchable as a Dave Chappelle, right? But these guys are still avoiding just, like you said, low-hanging fruit. So you guys are just taking, and I think that's also helped y'all's reach. Like, y'all are taking on stuff that nobody's touching, and ton of people are saying, finally, somebody's at least bringing this to light, even if in a funny, satirical way, but that brings it to the forefront. I'm like, man, this is insane. As much as this is a joke, this is an actuality, like what we've been saying. Do you think y'all's satire is reaching people in a way that, like, historians or, you know, people like Alan and I, like, who do like a history show, we can't reach? Do you think you guys are reaching those people?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, we kind of live in this post-truth culture. We all have short attention spans. We are being bombarded by so much information, an overabundance of information, you know, between, you know, TV and movies and podcasts and internet and, you know, just on our phones, you know, it's just, blah. It's amazing. You'd think that everyone being able to carry this little device that has the amassed knowledge of the entire world contained within it would make us smarter, but it's made us dumber, you know? So I think that our satire does kind of have this way of cutting through all that in the way that, you know, a well-researched book or a think piece, you know, might not, you know. And I think the powerful thing about laughter is it can catch you off guard. You know, I think a lot of laughter is kind of an unconscious or involuntary acknowledgement of a truth. You know, a lot of things are funny because they're true in some way. And we're big fans at the Babylon Bee. We're big fans of the writer G.K. Chesterton, who said that that humor can get in under the door while seriousness is still fumbling at the handle. So it does. And, you know, other satirists like Mark Twain, you know, Mark Twain said something to the effect of, and this isn't an exact quote, but, you know, the world's knowledge and the powers of man can, you know, push against a colossal lie, you know, maybe move it an inch, but only laughter and ridicule can just reduce it to atoms at a blast. You know, that foolishness and bad ideas cannot stand against ridicule. And so it does have this power, I think, especially in this culture that is just so bombarded by information and does have such a short attention span. So we hope that we're handling that power, you know, well.
No, I don't think so. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask you real quick, with the reaction, I mean, there's a lot of comedians now who are defending Chris Rock and, you know, they're saying, you know, that this is going too far. Like, you know, comedy is supposed to be comedy and yeah, you're going to, yeah. You know, there's a risk involved with comedy and you're going to offend people every once in a while, but, I wonder if the episode that happened on the Academy Awards might be kind of there be a kickback or whatever the term is, pushback to allow.
I bet you Chris Rock did get a kickback.
I'm sure he did.
You see those ratings?
Yeah. Tickets to go see his show have gone up like from the secondary market. But let me ask you: have you ever worked for or worked with the South Park team? Did they influence you at all, or?
No, we really, it's at the Babylon Bee, me and Kyle Mann. So we're the kind of the primary, we do a lot of the writing and the joke telling. We do have 7 or 8 part-time writers that do a lot as well. But I don't have a comedy background. I am a kind of like a Midwestern, you know, homeschooled evangelical Christian sheltered little kid. with, you know, I didn't grow up with the Simpsons. I didn't grow up watching Seinfeld, you know, all this, you know, I'm playing catch up now. Now that I'm a quote unquote comedy writer, I'm going back and thinking like, I got to watch, you know, the Simpsons now, because that's, you know, those early seasons are great satire. I need to understand what's going on with Seinfeld. So I was in, before working at the B, I was in the supply chain logistics sales. And I can already see you guys falling asleep as I said those words, you know,
I'm in IT.
Kyle Mann was all Kyle Mann was in, he was in like sales, selling like pipeline fixtures for underground water pipes or something like that. Like, none of us have these comedy backgrounds. I think we kind of almost see ourselves as like the uneducated, like the little kid that was the only one dumb enough to say the emperor had no clothes. Like, that's how we see ourselves. We're not comedic geniuses. We're just like the kid that's in the background going, hey, the emperor's naked, you know? And so there is an art and an engineering aspect to it. You know, you are doing wordsmithing. You have to kind of design things so that they're as punchy as possible. As you're reading them, you got to kind of design it for the person who is scrolling through their newsfeed. But yeah, we're not, we don't claim to be professionals at all. We're just telling jokes that make us laugh.
You know, I
forget what the question was. I just went off.
I was about the South Park team.
So it's funny, 'cause we since we've taken off, we have had people reach out to us. I mean, professional comedy writers who want to work for the Beast. I mean, we have a guy working for us now part-time that used to write for Frasier. We've had Simpsons writers reach out to us, you know, wanting to write stuff for us. So it is, we do feel like these kind of imposters, you know, where we're just these normal guys and these big time comedy writers are wanting to work for us. It's this weird kind of role reversal thing that's happened.
You know, when I was at A&M, my roommate's best friend ended up being one of the South Park people. Really? Yeah, it was one of the he did the voices, he did the cartoons, he did really?
Oh,
that's awesome. He did quite a bit. He was there for like the first 10-20 years.
10 or 20 years? That's like
actually,
a, that's
yeah,
like
they've
a
been around since 20. They've been around since 98.
Oh yeah, I know. But you said 10 or 20 years. You know,
yeah, but I know he was on there the first 10 or 15. He was in the that movie Bigger Better and whatever other one was.
There, I mean, it's a miracle that South Park is even still on the air. They're amazing satire, and they don't leave anyone out. I mean, they go after everyone. We've even thought about like what would a Babylon Bee version of South Park look like? You know, we're a bunch of like, you know, Christian kids. Like, what? How could we do something like that? You know, I don't know. More to come, I guess.
Well. So I don't know where I read it. It may have been on y'all's website or somewhere, but I think you guys had mentioned that y'all were going with, at the beginning, like non-political satire, and then all of a sudden, like y'all, I guess, threw in some political satire because it was almost just, like you said, low-hanging fruit, and you threw it out there and sort of I guess it sparked something of, you know, and people really gravitated to it. So was there a moment in time to where you guys almost have gone all in on the political satire? And they're like, this is what people are gravitating toward. I know you guys still do some of the Christian, satire, you do some of the, you know, the husband, the, like the core family values, like the husband with the list of things for the wife has told him to do type of thing, the Star Wars stuff, but it's primarily on the political level. Was there like a specific moment in time where you're like, hey, this is what's working and this is what's getting people's attention?
No, there wasn't. And it's actually kind of there's a bit of a misconception, I think, around the B that like we used to do Christian satire. And at some point there was this big switch and we went political. The very first article that was ever published on the site was a picture of Obama crying. And the headline was like Christian Start News Satire Site or something like that. Christian Conservative Start Satire Site and a picture of Obama. That was our very first headline. So we've always kind of done this political stuff. I think the mix has definitely changed. It used to be like 80%, you know, Christian culture stuff, 20% political. That is reversed to where it's more 80% political, 20% Christian culture. It's happened gradually. There was never really a moment where there was a switch made. It picked up more in the Trump years because Trump was just so fun to, you know, satirize. He's just such a character. I think a couple reasons. I guess the first reason is like there's only so many church jokes you can tell. I mean, you know, we have almost 10,000 articles on our site now. I mean, how many jokes can you make about worship leaders? You know, it's at some point you kind of like that well has run dry a little bit. Whereas the culture just gives us new things every week. So I think just part of it just arising out of the necessity to have fresh content every day, you run out of church stuff and whereas the world has given you, new things to laugh about. So I think in addition to that, there are a couple of huge fights that have really risen to the top as being, you know, that we see as being really important to fight these fights. You know, one of these being kind of like the woke ideology that has infested every institution in the United States. You know, we're seeing now the transgender movement. You see a lot of Babylon Bee jokes about, you know, the kind of the dissonance in trans ideology. I think we do sense that we do have kind of this responsibility to, in our own goofy little way, fight some of these big battles. And so that's why you've seen this focus on wokeness and some of this other stuff.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it used to be gay rights was the big issue. Now it's transgenderism. I wonder what's going to be in the next 10 years after the transgenderism is.
I think it's going to be transhumanist. Or pedophilia.
Will it be pedophilia? Yeah.
Not to bring the mood down here, but
bestiality. Yeah, I mean, that's yeah. You know, there's not enough attention paid to bestiality. So,
you know, I mean, it's really, I think without some kind of a massive reformation or spiritual revival or whatever, I do think it's just going to continue to go in the direction it's going, and it doesn't take a brilliant person to kind of see where it seems to be going. So
Say pedophilia is going there because that's been one of your whenever somebody says that this is a big push to protect pedophiles and the whole, you know, love in a very perverse definition, you know, for a long time. And I think even still people are like, oh, no, that's not what's going on. That's not what's going on. And it's sort of the same thing as what we've always seen throughout recent history is no, you're taking it too far. This is not what's happening. This is not what's happening. Then boom, it's happening. Yep. And you're like, yep. I thought you said this wasn't happening. And I think that you're spot on. I think that is probably the next one.
And you guys are history guys. You know that, you know, this, you know, all kinds of horrific crimes against children, you know, pederasty and all this stuff was a part of most cultures in the world, you know, up to a few thousand years ago. And I think the West kind of crawled out of this, some of these terrible things over the last 2000 years to where we've arrived now, where we, you know, women have dignity and rights, and we have this idea of age of consent and things like that. And the progressives really are not progressing to anything, but to where we were 2000, 3000 years ago. So there's nothing new under the sun. So I guess we shouldn't be surprised.
Yeah. And it's cyclical, right? So it's all it's you're pushing against something that is wicked, that is pushing against you, that believes what they're pushing for is pure and positive. Right. And it's
the hearings for the Supreme Court nominee.
Yeah, Ketanji Jackson. Yeah.
Yes. Okay. I can never remember her name, but I don't even know if she's been voted in or not.
I don't
not,
think she's been voted in yet. But
I remember Lindsey Graham's reaction about throwing them in jail for 50 years and the news reporters were talking about how rude he was to her. And I'm like, going, he's making a point about pedophilia and pedophiles and pedophilia. And, you know, so I think she's going to kind of lay the groundwork. I'd pay attention to her because of her record. And you know, she's not being, oh God, she's going to give y'all a lot of material. There was a, there was a question given to her. Do you believe something about the freedom of speech, freedom of this and that? And she was like, yes, it's a fundamental right, that, you know, everyone should have the right to free speech, free this. And then they're like, okay, well, what about the Second Amendment? And she's like, well, the Supreme Court says that the Second Amendment is an individual right. And she left it at that. She didn't say about the right to self-defense or anything. She was like, well, the Supreme Court said. So, but I think she's going to give y'all a lot of material when the subjects of pedophilia and...
I think so. Yeah. Well, you know, I think that she is really, she's been sent there as kind of almost a torpedo. I think that she's an activist. She seems to be an activist at heart, handpicked by activists, and her job is to, you know, she's the culmination of the kind of the 1619 project view of history that, you know, we have to dismantle the Constitution as written because it's created this system, this racist system, you know. That's my suspicion anyway, you know.
Well, it's not a suspicion. The 1619 Project came out very clearly that they are not for the Constitution. They're not for the foundational principles of our country.
Ruth Bader Ginsburg was saying they need to look beyond the Constitution for international laws. But, you know, if you look at, you know, how far this country has gone, you know, look, I'm in my 50s and, you know, I remember how it was in the 70s and the 80s.
You look good for 50s, by the way. I just throwing it out there. I don't know what your regimen is,
I drink milk.
Milk?
Only animals drink milk.
Well, I owe it to my parents, pretty much. But, you know, but if you looked at, you know, the whole thing, the frog analogy and all that, if you look at what, you know, the frog in the boiling water, if you look at where we were in the 70s and 80s and then fast forward to today, I think our founding fathers, I think any of the guys that fought in World War II are looking, they'd be turning in their graves or spinning in their graves or whatever the phrases.
I think anybody even from the 1960s and 70s would be rolling in their grave. If let's just take, for instance, the abortion situation, like those things going on, right? At the start of that, it was like, okay, abortion, like early term abortion, no one in their right mind during that time would have said late term abortion, you know, and definitely not abortion as the baby is coming out, and definitely not, you know, the new thing I think in Baltimore where there's a bill that was just introduced to let a baby lay unattended for 28 days, you know, up to 20. It was like, you know, that's infanticide, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's what you were alluding to earlier was you're hitting it at the forefront because, you know, in the long term, this is what the ultimate goal is. The ultimate goal is if we can just slowly but surely, the frog in the boiling water, if we can just slowly but surely get to where we're wanting to go under the name of progress or under the name of democracy or human rights or whatever we want to call it, if it goes slow enough, then it'll be done. People will pass and people will be okay with it. But if you start at A and try to accomplish Z, it'll never happen because people will be like, are you insane? Because the culture is not prepared for something like that. So it is, the frog is the American culture and the boiling of the water is what progressives, as you would call them now, are doing. They're just slowly but surely turning up the heat. And all of a sudden our culture is now not, it's not American traditional values. Like it's 50-50 and like the country is split. And you said earlier, you're evangelical, you're Christian. And so are we, we're both Christians. But this stuff is entered into the church, which is really, really irritating, frustrating. I remember, going on the United Methodist Church's website and first thing that pops up is Robin DiAngelo teaching a course on white fragility. and white privilege. And like, this ideology under the guise of not democracy, not anything else, but under the guise of Christianity, when it's the complete opposite of Christianity. How do you guys, as Christians and evangelicals, how do you guys deal with that or look at that whenever you are talking about what's going on in the church?
Yeah. Well, it's weird because I when it comes to the evangelical world, I think a lot of people kind of fell victim to this ideology from a good place. Like they have good hearts. They want to do the right thing. They want to love their neighbor. They want to, you know, bring about racial reconciliation, and they want to, you know, reach the world for Jesus and all that stuff. And so I think the church has always done this. The Bible calls us sheep for a reason. We're all kind of idiots. And we tend to hop on bandwagons. I think, you know, there's precedent for it too. I mean, the Christians in the 70s, there was a huge population. Remember, I don't know if the population bomb scare. We all thought we were going to die of overpopulation and mass famine and starvation. And there were Christians, prominent Christians of all stripes at that time, seriously saying to their churches, you know, maybe we shouldn't have so many kids. You know, maybe God is calling us to stop, you know, reproducing. You know, and so I think that like these cultural waves kind of come and go. When it comes to the church, it does seem like it's waning a little bit. I think a lot of Christians are kind of becoming wise to it and snapping out of it. And a lot of other Christians are digging in. And I think the Christians that dig in and remain in this ideology will eventually abandon Christianity and embrace what is just essentially an ideology, a godless ideology. So, I think it'll run its course. I have faith that, you know, God will continue to preserve his church as he has through the ages. And, I think the hope that I have, we talk about this frog in the boiling water thing. You know, the problem that this ideology has, as they're trying to build this utopia is human nature itself. Their enemy is not just God, but human nature and free will. And eventually that is going to assert itself. There has to become a breaking point to where that water becomes too hot and truth and human nature begin to reassert themselves. And I think that we probably have a little bit further to go into the darkness before we get there, but I think it will snap back. I think the thing that keeps me joyful, and we really do try to kind of keep this joyful feeling with what we do, even though at the Babylon Bee we're talking about some really dark subjects sometimes. We try to keep a perspective, and as you guys, you know, being students of history, I think would know that. You know, kingdoms come and go, countries come and go, ideologies come and go. They run their course. Sometimes they do a lot of damage in the meantime. You know, for the Christian, our hope is that, you know, the truth has its own voice. The word of God stands forever, and things come back. Things are cyclical. So, regardless of how things go in our short lifetimes, that's not really for us to decide or control. All we can do is speak the truth in our own way, do what we can, and leave the rest to God. So, when you have kind of this tragic view of the world where you're willing to accept that sometimes things won't go the way you hope they will go, you can then kind of like give that burden to God and just kind of have fun in the meantime. You know, it's not quite a black pill. It's like a, there's this hope that you, and this joy that you can have even as things are really seem to be going downhill.
Yeah. But where I might disagree with you on the optimism is the fact that they are targeting children. I mean, you know, about Florida was, you know, Governor DeSantis was saying that, first of all, it doesn't say don't say gay. You wouldn't know that by looking at Ron Perlman or some of those other idiots. But he was saying, just don't talk about sexuality to kindergarten to third grade. Now, there's nothing unreasonable about suggesting that you shouldn't talk about sexuality to kids under, you know, within the third grade. But, you know, the communism lasted, has been going on now for over 100 years. And part of the reason is because they teach children from the very beginning that, you know, how good communism is. Now, communism began really, I think, in France during the revolution, the French Revolution, but it only lasted for a few years. Came back in, 1871 during the Paris Commune. But that's because there were too many Catholics. There was too much Christianity. But when you get the kids and you phase out the Christian church and do rotten things to it and allow rotten things to occur, you know, I talk to kids today out of high school and their minds, their big thing is transgenderism. What's that blockers thing? Whatever blocker?
That's where I lose my sense of humor when we talk about what's being done to kids. I become a raving lunatic online. It's because it really is. It's infuriating to see. You know, I can argue with adults about all the insanity of these ideologies, but when you start putting it into kids' heads, that's where jokes. That's where you might be called to do something beyond just joking about it.
Yeah, I mean, and to your point, and I got one more final question about truth that I want to get to. But the Soviet Union, like Vladimir Lenin, like that was how they were going to continue communism. And John Dewey, when he went over to the Soviet Union, studied the Soviet-style public education system. And he was taking notes of... They are taking the children, and it was by law you had to send your kids to the public schools. The teachers were teaching them about the party, like you are party first and family somewhere down the line, right? And he was talking about how they get them for, you know, 5 to 6 to 8 hours a day, and it was required. And he was also at the same time, like what they're teaching, and they are, as he said, they are sapping the ecclesiastical virtues from the family, and they're sapping it through the children. And so I see that's what's been going on in the public education system. I'm constantly saying, get your kids out of the public education system. And I'm constantly saying that. And I've got some of my best friends who are public education, like public school teachers, right? But I'm like, get them out of there, because we live in Texas and there's some effed up stuff going on in the Texas school systems. And we're a red state, you know, there's effed up stuff going on in Florida, and that's a red state. Can you imagine what's going on in the blue states?
Oh, it doesn't even matter. I mean, you can go to like Podunk Town, Idaho. Public school there, it's the same stuff. It's amazing how it has wormed its way through. It doesn't matter where you go, how conservative the area is. Like the public school educators that are allowed into this system and allowed to teach our kids it's completely vetted now. Like it's vetted for this ideology. And it's weird. I saw it when I went to, you know, finished my college in, you know, 2000, from 2006 to 2010, it was a lot of my friends who were in education, you know, would drop out their freshman, sophomore year because they were like, this is not what I signed up for. Like they are aggressively pushing ideology on me. And they could tell at that point they weren't going to be allowed to graduate unless they accepted it wholeheartedly. And so, you know, we're 10 years removed from that now, and all these people are teaching. It's great. This isn't too discouraging for a comedy podcast now, is it? Were we supposed to be having more fun?
No, man, this is not a comedy podcast. This is history. This is harsh reality meeting comedy, you know? So yeah.
Well, hey, listen, I wore this for you. So
there's our comedy bit.
That's where comedy shines. I think, you know, like when you're dealing with dark, heavy subjects, the remedy and the antidote, the balm, in those, in these sorts of times is laughter, is comedy. It really, I mean, I think that's the other, one of the most important aspects of what we do. We're not just trying to just throw the truth out there and fight the culture wars. Most of the feedback we get are just, you guys are like, you're the only thing keeping me from going crazy right now. Like I boot you up. I see all the craziness in the news, and then I go to the Babylon Bee and I can have some levity. You know, it's just a relief to people. And that's really, really important function of comedy right now.
Well, I want to point out, if you look at the cover of this book, it shows they're eating their own. You're not radical enough. You've got a Antifa guy or a BLM guy looking at a Che Guevara guy, and they're pissed off at each other because neither one of them are woke enough for the other. That's what we're dealing with right there. And this isn't, I mean, this is reality. And this is why I really recommend this book, because yes, it's satire, but it's the truth.
Yeah.
It'll be an interesting little time capsule, I think, you know, for people, you know, 50 years, 100 years from now, I hope that book is still around where people can be like, what the heck was going on in like 2020, 2022? Like, they'll be able to pull up this book and be like, okay, they were crazy.
Yeah, if they don't force us to burn all the copies. So,
That's
yeah.
Right.
So Joel, my last question, I don't know if Alan will have another one, but my last question is about a comparison between you guys and the book 1984. And I know you guys are probably big fans of that book. In that book, the final scene is the how many fingers am I holding up scene, right? And you've got O'Brien, the villain, torturing the protagonist, Winston, and he's holding up four fingers. And he's torturing him, and he's trying to make him see five fingers instead of four. And eventually, he does. Eventually, he just concedes to, yes, I see five fingers, because the torture is too much. I see some similarities between that, what you guys do, but also this most recent situation going on with the Rachel Levine Man of the Year situation, which is absolutely comical. The whole idea, like when that whole thing took place, I'm like, this has got to be a joke. And then come to find out, like, no, that Biden actually did put her as... him as admiral. Anyways, I'm all confused. So is the stance from the Babylon Bee about conceding the truth to a lie? And do you think that more people will follow y'all's lead to stop conceding the truth to a lie? And a lot of times people will concede just to be able to stay on Twitter and social media platforms. And you guys are like, who gives a crap? Like, we're not going to be able to be on Twitter. At least we're not Winston. You know, at least we're not saying, okay, whatever you want, I'll do. I will abandon my principles in order to succeed or stay in the light.
Yeah, it's... That was a tough decision to make. Because, you know, we have people that their livelihoods depend on what we're doing. I think that's where a lot of people fold, is because they need to make a paycheck, you know, and sometimes it's easier to just capitulate than fight the fight. And so we, for exactly the reason that you kind of outlined there, you know, if we are willing to, you know, capitulate and compromise on what is a very basic, fundamental, self-evident, undeniable truth to keep some Twitter followers. That seems to us like an open door, or maybe like the first cut of a death by a thousand cuts, that leads to us losing our, I guess our soul as people who want to tell the truth to the culture. And our hope is that it encourages other people to do the same. I know that I don't judge anyone who can't, because not everyone is in the position to be able to do what we're doing. But it has, I mean, so a few things happened. Tucker Carlson, the Fox News host, he retweeted our joke and he got banned from Twitter as well. Last week, he through a spokesman, he revealed that he is not going to delete the tweet either. He is going to remain off of Twitter if that's what it takes to, you know, to stand for the truth. And so I really admire him for that. I don't know if anyone else has been forced into that situation and made that stand either. I think, you know, losing a million Twitter followers is a small price to pay. You know, thankfully, you know, I God is sustaining us. Our traffic is still good. People are still finding our satire. And it's something we were always prepared for. We always kind of anticipated that a day would come when we would have no social media avenues to do what we do. And so we were always kind of mentally prepared for it. When it all goes away, when we're kicked off the internet completely, we'll write it on, we'll staple it to telephone poles and you know, deliver it into mailboxes. So that's, you know, the views are nice, but that's not what drives us. You know, we'll keep getting the truth out there however we can, I guess.
If I can make a suggestion, there's a guy who does satire videos. He's a guy with the long red hair, and I don't remember his name.
Oh, yeah.
He's out in California.
He endorsed our book. Where is it? I don't know if it made it. He may have sent it in late.
But what he does, one of the things that I noticed him doing, because he was being harassed by Facebook. By the way, I saw one of your satire posts was slapped on with a third party found this post, deceiving. But what he does is he will have a video on Facebook that says, if you want to see what I posted, go to such and such site. So he won't put the actual video on Facebook. He will just direct people to a different platform or a different website so that you can watch it.
Don't you think they know what they're doing? Do you know how successful the Babylon Bee is? Are you new to this? What is going on? You think that haven't sat there and talked about ways? The guy just said he was going to post stuff on telephone posts.
I've had it up to here with your, you know, you can't talk to me that way. I've got intersectionality. You don't. You're a white Anglo-Saxon
cis something.
Whatever, cis person, cisgender. Me, I'm Middle Eastern. You can't talk to me this way.
Okay.
That's right.
And I'm almost a senior citizen. Give me a few more years and I'll be a senior citizen.
That's right. What are you going to say, Joe?
Oh, I don't know.
Exactly.
No, Facebook has killed links. So anything that we have with a link back to our site is not going to get any traffic. So we're actually working on something right along the lines of what you said. So when we share our articles as just a picture, they get a lot more traffic because Facebook kind of doesn't know what's going on. So we're gonna put a little blurb in that picture saying, hey, if you want to read the really, really hilarious article, you know, check out the BabylonBee.com. I don't know how much traffic that'll generate, but you know, and we built our own social network too. I don't know. It's few people know this, but we have this thing called Not the Bee that is a bit of a social network. If you subscribe, you become a part of, it's almost like a Twitter style, Twitter and Facebook combined almost social network as kind of a backup. So if everything goes away, at least we have Not the Bee and you'll be able to find us on there. So,
well, I think it's just important on knowing who your audience is, because I remember a while ago,
speaking of knowing who your audience is, we got to wrap this up.
All right. I'll mention this real quick. There was, during election season, there was a Democrat running and he advertised on a conservative site. He sounded kind of conservative, but when I went into an office working in IT and there was a liberal there and she was listening to a liberal radio station, same guy, but his message was far more to the left. So that's, you know, yeah. So that's why it depends on who your audience is. And if Twitter is going to be anal about certain things, just tell them what they want to hear, but then...
Anal? Really? We're going there? Anyways. All right, Joe. Hey, dude, this has been a lot of fun, and I know you guys got another book. You were saying another book coming out sometime this year. Guide to Democracy. Man, we cannot wait for that one to come out and hopefully have you on the show again. Ladies and gentlemen, the book is called The Babylon Bee's Guide to Wokeness. Get woke and then go broke.
It's a funny possibly. Book. It's a funny book. It's got great illustrations.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. We didn't talk about the pictures. It has a lot of pictures in it. It's a great toilet reader.
A lot of violence in here with Antifa beating up people with peace signs.
Fighting fascism with violence. It's important skill to learn.
That's right. Go brown shirts. So, hey, man, thanks again for being on the podcast. We really, really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, guys. Likewise. Looking forward to coming on again, maybe later.
You got it. Well, that was funny, fun, but also pretty dark, deep, because the stuff that this country is allowing is just insane.
I'm glad I got a chance to thank him for the Star Wars one, because that was I busted out laughing for a very long time. But it's unfortunate that it's not satire anymore. It is the state of our nation and state of Western democracy, Western civilization.
Yeah.
Oh Lord. So if you really want to recognize it, if you want to see it, read this book.
Yeah.
And you'll be like, wow, that's when I saw like Ron Perlman and all those people just coming out of the woodwork. Governor DeSantis for saying that if you're from K through the third grade, don't talk about sexuality.
Dude, if you're K through freaking 12th grade, like it shouldn't even be taught in schools. Yeah. Like that, and that's the thing is schools are the source of a lot of these issues, primary source of a lot of these issues, because they're not even teaching. One, freaking what? Math is racist, right? Science is out of the question.
Being on time is racist. You can't have that third period bell or first period. You don't need to be on time to classes.
It's absolute insanity. And the thing is, what is it?
And the Smithsonian was saying that being on time is white privilege.
Yeah.
So we're not.
Yeah, this is not like under the radar and nobody knows about. These are prominent people. Freaking, the new Supreme Court nominee doesn't know what a woman is because she's not a biologist. Like, how stupid are we getting?
If they're going to sit and say that religion shouldn't be taught in school, then social dogma and indoctrination shouldn't either. It should be math, the basics, math,
the basics, exactly.
Literature, although literature, they do have stuff in there
too. Right, but I mean, you should know how to read and write, you know, which apparently there are no more proficiency levels, more standards chemistry, out in Oregon.
Biology, you need to learn biology so you'll know what a man and a woman what they are.
Chemistry, just in case physics, your parents haven't told you because they're not biologists.
General sciences. So.
Get the book. That's a book recommendation. And then also my movie recommendation is a movie called Idiocracy. This came out in like 2006. It has Luke Wilson, Owen Wilson's brother. People know who he is. Luke Wilson. Maya Rudolph, she's hilarious in the movie. She's on SNL, has played Kamala Harris. Terry Crews is on there. So it's a very funny movie, but it's also almost true to life when you're looking at it like, man, people have lost their minds to the point where they just they don't know what 2 + 2 is. They can't tell you what is so obvious in front of them. Yeah,
you got to use Common Core math to do 2 + 2. So
yeah,
but yeah, this is my book. This is my book recommendation. Also, is this book? I read it. I loved it. It was a good laugh, and it's a sad commentary because this is the state of our country, Western civilization, our churches, everything. Yeah. Now, in terms of my movie recommendation, we were discussing what's going on with Disney, where they want half the characters to be the, people of color, LGBTQ, blah, 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 whatever. But if you go back to the 50s, and while Disney was still alive, it's a very different Disney. So my movie recommendation is going to be Johnny Tremaine. It was made in the 50s. I can't tell you who was in it because I don't know any famous people, but it's off a book that won the Newbery Award about the American Revolution, how it started up in the Boston area. But the things that you will see, it's a pro-America movie. It's a pro-liberty movie. And there's a scene in there where the Patriots are saying, everyone, we need guns. If you don't have a gun, someone can get you a gun, something like that, which you would not see in a Disney movie today. So, you know, I think if you don't want your kids to be woke, have them watch Johnny Tremaine so they'll know how our country was founded and what liberty is all about.
Yeah, that's where we need to start. All right, ladies and gentlemen, well, that brings our show to an end. Where can people find us?
Well, they can find us on Facebook. They can find us on Instagram. You know, like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Is that what it is?
It doesn't matter. Go.
Something. Instagram. YouTube. You know, subscribe to us on YouTube. And then we have our own page, which is www.thesonsofhistory.com.
Our own page.
And I know you won't get shirts like
also
this.
Also known as a website.
Yes,
coming from the webpage. IT guy has no idea what the difference is.
But you won't find a shirt like this. You actually have to go and, you know, beat up a homeless guy in San Francisco.
As you did, yeah.
Shirt like this. It's but a great we do have Sons of History shirts.
Exactly. And they're very cool. Some Ronald Reagan shirts, some World War II shirts. Pretty cool stuff. All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's it. We will talk to you later. Hope you have a great week and go get this book so you too, like Alan, can be woke.